Seraphine Meriwether did not know that the man who held the key to her cell was the Alpha King of the River Country, or that the kindest thing he would ever do for her was the thing she would fight him hardest over. She knew only the cold of the stone beneath her, the iron taste of the air, and the sound of the river running somewhere far below, ceaseless and indifferent, like a voice that had been speaking long before she arrived and would keep speaking long after she was gone. She had been a scout, a messenger when the roads were too dangerous for anyone slower. She had carried words between the border holds for 3 winters, and she had been good at it, fast and quiet and difficult to catch, until the night they caught her. It had not been a fair fight. She remembered that much. She remembered the lanterns swinging in the dark, the shouts, the way her horse had screamed and gone down, and then the rope, the hood, the long jolting ride to a place she could not see. She had expected the worst. She had braced for it the way she braced for cold water, all at once, teeth set, breath held. The worst had not come. That was the thing she could not understand. They had taken her to Duskwater Hold, a citadel of pale stone built into the cliff above the river, where the water folded white over the rocks and the towers caught the last light like the tips of spears. They had put her in a clean cell with a real cot and a real blanket. They had brought her bread that was not stale and water that did not smell of the bucket. And on the second morning, a woman with steady hands and gray streaks in her braid had come to clean the gash along Seraphine's brow and had told her, almost gently, that the king would see her when she was ready. The king. Seraphine had laughed at that, a short, disbelieving sound, because the king of the river country was a story mothers told. The Alpha. The one who had held the 3 holds together when everything else came apart. Men like that did not concern themselves with a captured scout who carried other people's words for coin. And then the door had opened, and he had filled it. He was tall in the way that made a room feel smaller, broad through the shoulders, with chestnut hair loose to his collar and a single warrior braid threaded back from one temple. He wore a brigandine the deep color of river pine, a wolf worked in gold across one shoulder, and a thin circlet that she would not have noticed at all if the healer had not gone still and lowered her eyes. His own eyes were pale gold, the color of light through honey, and they found Seraphine and stayed there with a weight she felt in her chest. "You're awake," he said. His voice was low and even, a voice used to being obeyed without ever being raised. "Good. I wanted to ask you something before anyone else does." She lifted her chin. Her wrists were not bound. She noticed that too, and hated that she noticed it. Hated the small flicker of gratitude that rose in her before she could stamp it down. "Ask then. The words you carried." He stepped inside, slow, the way a person moves around a frightened animal. "Who are they for?" "I don't read what I carry." "No. But you know who paid you." She held his gaze. This was the part she had braced for. This was where the kindness ended and the real thing began. The questions, the pressure, the slow tightening. She had decided on the road that she would tell them nothing, and she set her jaw and prepared to tell him nothing now. He watched her decide it. Something moved behind his eyes that might almost have been respect. "You won't say," he said, "not a question." "No." He nodded once, as if she had confirmed something he already believed. She waited for the turn. She had seen it 100 times on the road, in toll houses and border posts, the moment a reasonable man stopped being reasonable because reason had not gotten him what he wanted. She watched his hands for it. She watched his shoulders. She had learned to read a body the way other people read words. And his body told her nothing she expected. Then he did the thing she would not understand for a long time afterward. He crouched, so that his eyes were level with hers, close enough that she could see the fine lines at their corners, the marks of a man who spent his days squinting into weather and worry, and he said quietly, "You were carrying a warning, not a plot. I know that. The men who took you didn't, and the men I answer to still don't. I needed to see your face when I asked. Now I have." "And what did my face tell you?" she said, because she could not help it, because the not knowing was worse than any threat. "That you'd die before you gave up a name." Something almost like sorrow moved through the gold of his eyes. "And that no one's ever given you a reason not to expect to." It struck closer than a blow would have. She had armored herself against the things she knew were coming. She had no armor for that. She looked away first, at the wall, at the small high window where the river light came in cold, and when she looked back, he was already rising to his feet. And he left. The cold came back when the door shut, deeper for his having been there to push it off a while. She sat with it a long time. She turned his words over and over, looking for the hook in them, the place where the kindness became a hold. She could not find it. That frightened her more than finding it would have. She did not sleep. The healer's name was Petra. She came every morning, and she did not pretend the situation was anything other than what it was, which Seraphine found she preferred to gentleness that lied. Petra changed the dressing on her brow, checked the bruising along her ribs, and answered questions with the flat honesty of a woman too old to bother with anything else. "He's not what they say," Petra told her on the fourth day, packing her satchel. "He's worse, in a way. The cruel ones you can predict. Him you can't. He'll do the decent thing even when it costs him, and it's cost him plenty." "Then why am I still in a cell?" Petra paused at the door. "Because the cell is the safest place in this hold for you right now. Ask him why, if you want the truth. He won't lie to you. It's a flaw in him." That night, Seraphine lay awake listening to the river and thinking about a man who would not lie to her, and she did not know what to do with the thought, so she folded it small and put it away. The marshal came on the fifth day. She heard him before she saw him, the hard ring of boots on stone, the kind of walk that wanted to be heard. He was older than the king, gray through the wool of his surcoat, a gorget of blackened steel at his throat, and a copper chain of office across his chest. His eyes were the flat gray of flint, and they went over her the way a man counts coin. "So this is the courier," Marshal Vossberg said. "Smaller than I expected. They always are." He turned to the guard at his shoulder. "She's worth more than her weight in the right room. Send word to the Eastern Holds that we have one of their runners. Let them come to the table to buy her back, and let them learn what it costs to send spies under my walls." "I'm not a spy," Seraphine said. "You're whatever I need you to be." He did not even look at her when he said it. That was the part that frightened her, more than a raised hand would have. To him, she was not a person at all. She was a chip on a board, a thing to be moved. And the not looking told her he had already moved 100 like her and would move 100 more and never once lie awake over any of them. She had spent her life among such men. She knew the breed. They did not hate you. Hate would at least have been a kind of attention. They simply did not see you. And a person they did not see was a person they could spend. "The king said I'm not to be sold," she said, testing it, watching his face. For the first time, the flint eyes came to her, and there was something in them that made her wish she had stayed quiet. "The king," Vossberg said softly, "is young, and soft in the one place a king cannot afford to be soft. He'll learn. They always learn." He turned for the door. "Sleep well, courier. You're worth a great deal to me, and I take care of my property." The door shut on his boots, and the cold came back deeper than before. She did not sleep that night either. She lay on the cot, and she did the thing she had taught herself to do as a child, when the house was loud and there was nowhere to go and no one came when you called. She made herself very small and very still inside, and she planned. She knew the count of the guards by now, had counted them through the door without seeming to, the way she counted everything. She knew the watch changed at the second bell, when the river mist came up thick off the water and the torches guttered, and a person moving low along the wall would be one more gray shape among many. She knew there was a postern gate on the riverside, because she had heard the hinge of it crying in the wind two nights running. And a hinge that cried was a hinge that was used, and a gate that was used was a gate that opened. She would have one chance. She would not waste it on hope. Hope was for people who had somewhere soft to land. She would simply go, the way she had always gone, fast and quiet and difficult to catch. And she would not look back at the pale stone or the gold-eyed man or the strange, unwelcome warmth of being, for 6 days, treated as though she were real. The king came to her the next morning before she could. He came alone, without the healer, without a guard, and he stood in the open door with the key still in his hand, and he said the thing that broke her plan apart in her chest like ice going over a fall. "You're free to go." She stared at him. "I mean it," he said. "The marshal wants to sell you back to the Eastern Holds. I've overruled him. I don't keep people to trade them. The road out is yours. Petra has packed you food and a cloak. There's a horse." He set the key down on the small table by the door, deliberately, so that she could see he was leaving it behind. "No one will stop you at the gate. I've given the word." She did not move. She did not trust it. Every part of her that had survived 3 winters on dangerous roads was screaming that this was the trap, the real one, the kind dressed up as mercy so you would walk into it on your own feet. "Why?" she said. It came out rough. He was quiet for a moment. The pale gold of his eyes did not waver. "Because you didn't do anything wrong," he said simply. "And because I would rather lose the advantage than keep a person who wants to be gone. Go, Seraphine, while the marshal's at the East Tower and the way is clear." It was the first time he had said her name. She felt it land somewhere under her ribs, an odd warm pressure, and she resented it, because she did not have time to feel things. She got to her feet. Her legs held. She took the cloak Petra had left folded on the cot, the food, the small purse with her own few coins returned to it, every copper, which she noticed and which made her throat tighten in a way she refused to examine. She walked past him through the door. He did not reach for her. He stood aside, all that height and strength held perfectly still, and let her pass. The corridor was empty. The yard beyond was washed in early gray, the mist coming up off the river just as she had known it would, and a saddled horse stood waiting by the wall with its breath smoking in the cold. The gate stood open. Beyond it, the road dropped away toward the trees and the freedom she had been counting on for 6 days. She crossed the yard. Her heart was hammering. 3 winters of instinct carried her forward. 1 foot, then the next, toward the open gate and the gray world past it. 1 step, 2, 3. And then she heard the door behind her open again, and his boots on the stone, unhurried, certain, following. She spun. He had come out into the yard after her, the circlet catching the dull light, his expression no longer composed but something rawer, something she had not seen on him before. "You said I was free to go," she said. Her voice shook. "You gave me the horse. You opened the gate." "I did." He stopped a few paces from her. The mist moved between them. "And I meant every word of it. You are free. The gate is open, and no one will close it." He drew a breath, and it was unsteady, and that more than anything stopped her where she stood. "But I find I can't watch you walk through it without telling you the truth first. Then you can go, and I won't follow again. You have my word, and I don't break it." "What truth?" "That the first time I looked at you in that cell, something in me went quiet that has never been quiet." He said it the way a man confesses to a crime. "I've spent 6 days telling myself it was nothing. that I'd feel the same letting any innocent person go. I don't. I came out here because I would rather make a fool of myself in this yard than spend the rest of my life wondering what would have happened if I'd said nothing. His jaw tightened. So now you know. The road is still yours, Seraphine. I won't take a single step more toward you than this. But I had to tell you before you took the road, and I lost the chance. The river ran on below them. The horse shifted and blew. And Seraphine stood in the open mouth of the gate she had dreamed about for 6 days, with everything she wanted on one side of her and something she had not let herself want on the other, and found that her feet would not carry her either way. She had been built to leave. That was the thing he could not know. She had left every place that had ever held her, because leaving was the only power a girl with nothing had ever been given. Stay and be used, or go and be free. There had never been a third thing. The first house had taught her that. The loud one, the one she had made herself small inside of until small, was the only shape she knew. Every house after had only confirmed it. You stayed and they took what they wanted, or you went into the cold, and at least the cold was honest about what it was. He was offering her a third thing. He was offering her the gate and standing back from it, which was the one thing no one had ever done. They had always either chained her or cast her out. He had unlocked the chain and then refused to push her through the door, and the not pushing undid her more thoroughly than any chain ever had. A chain she could have fought. A chain she understood. This open-handed, gold-eyed patience that asked for nothing and blocked nothing was a thing she had no defense against, because it did not attack the walls she had built. It simply waited outside them, in the cold, for as long as it took, and made no demand at all. "You're a fool," she said, and her voice cracked down the middle. "Most likely. You don't know me." "No." A breath. "But I would like the years it takes to fix that, if you'll give them. And if you won't, I'll open this gate for you every morning for the rest of my life, and never once close it." She did not decide to cross the distance. Her body simply did it, the way it had carried her toward the gate a moment before, 3 steps in the other direction now, and her hands found the front of his brigandine and fisted there. And she pressed her face against the cold gold of the wolf at his shoulder and shook. He did not crush her to him. He brought one hand up slow, the way he did everything, and laid it against the back of her head, and held her as if she were something he had been entrusted with rather than something he had won. "I have you," he said into her hair, "if you'll be had." "I don't know how to stay," she whispered. "I've never once stayed." "Then we'll learn it together. One day, then another. You can leave any morning you choose, and I'll still be standing here the next." His arms tightened, just slightly, and she felt the unsteadiness in him, the relief, the thing he had been holding back. "But I'm asking you to choose this one. Stay this one morning." She stayed that morning. The mist burned off the river by midday, and she was still inside the walls when it did. And she told herself it was only because her ribs ached and the road was long. She told herself the same thing the next morning, and the next. And somewhere in the telling, it stopped being a thing she had to tell herself. The marshal did not let it go. She had known he wouldn't. A man like Vossberg did not lose a chip from his board and shrug. He waited, the way patient, cruel men wait, and he chose his moment, which was the high feast at the end of the first week, when the hold was full of the river lords and their wives, and the long hall blazed with candles, and the king sat at the head of the table with Seraphine seated, by his own command, at his right hand. She wore a gown that night, the first she had worn in years, deep green to match nothing and no one, and she felt the eyes of the hall on her, the captured courier raised up to the king's right like a queen, and she held her chin level the way she had learned to as a child and let them look. The hall was a long blaze of candles, banners hung from the rafters, the river lords ruddy with wine and the smell of roasted meat and pine smoke thick in the warm air. She had spent her life on the outside of rooms like this, carrying messages to their doors and never crossing their thresholds. And here she sat at the head of the longest table she had ever seen, the king's hand resting easy beside her own on the dark wood. She did not feel like a queen. She felt like a runner who had stopped running and was waiting, every nerve awake, for the cost of stopping to come and find her. It always came. She had never once gotten something for nothing, and the seat at the king's right hand was a great deal of something. The cost rose with a cup in its hand at the far end of the table. Fossberg rose for it, and the hall quieted for him the way halls quiet for men who have made themselves feared. "My lords," he said, smooth as oil, "we feast tonight in good company, though I confess I am surprised to find a spy of the Eastern Holds seated at our king's own right hand, eating his bread, wearing his colors." He turned the flint of his eyes on her. "Tell me, girl, does the East know you've traded your loyalty for a soft seat? Or are you still carrying their words, only now from inside our walls?" The hall stirred. Seraphine felt the old cold come up in her, the instinct to make herself small, to slip the noose by going quiet and still. She did not. She stood instead. She set her own cup down with a click that carried in the silence, and she met the marshal's flat, gray stare across the length of the table, and she found that 6 days of mercy and a week of mournings had given her something she had not had on the road. A floor to stand on. A reason to. "I carried warnings," she said, clear enough to reach the back of the hall. "Not plots. A warning that the bridge at Caldermouth was failing and the autumn trains would fall through it. A warning that the fever was in the southern villages before it reached the roads. I carried the words that kept your own people alive, Marshal. And you'd sell me to a table of strangers to make yourself look strong." She let her voice drop, and it carried further low than it had loud. "I am not your chip. I never was. And the only loyalty I've traded is the loyalty I'm choosing to give, in the open, in front of all of you, to a man who opened a gate and stood back from it." The hall was utterly still. And then the king rose beside her, and the stillness sharpened into something with an edge. He did not shout. She was learning that he never did. He set one hand flat on the table and he looked down its length at his marshal with eyes gone hard as struck gold. And when he spoke, his voice was quiet enough that every soul in the hall leaned in to catch it. "Marshal Vossberg, you will apologize to the lady, and then you will surrender your chain of office, because a man who would sell the innocent to look strong has no business holding the safety of my people in his hands." He let the words settle. "I gave you that chain to protect the weak. You wanted to trade them. We are finished, you and I." Vossberg's face went white, then red. "You would break a marshal of 30 years over a courier, a border runner, a nothing." "She is not a nothing." The king did not raise his voice, and somehow that was worse than if he had. "She is the woman who will sit at my right hand for as long as she chooses to. And you have just shown this hall exactly the kind of man you are. The chain, Marshal. Now." For a long moment, Seraphine thought it might come to worse than words. Then the marshal's hand went to the copper chain at his chest, and he lifted it over his head, and he set it down on the table with a sound that rang in the silence. And he walked from the hall with the eyes of every lord he had ever frightened following him out. The candles guttered. The river ran on beyond the walls. The king turned to her, and the hardness was gone from his face as if it had never been. And what was left was the rawness she had seen in the yard, the thing he did not show to halls full of lords. "I'm sorry," he said, low, for her alone. "You shouldn't have had to do that." "No." She was shaking again, the way she had in the yard, the aftermath of standing where she had always run. "But I'm glad I did. I've spent my whole life slipping out of rooms, Cassius. That's the first time I ever stood in one and stayed." It was the first time she had said his name. She watched it land on him the way hers had landed on her, that same warm pressure, and his breath caught, and his hand came up to her face slow and careful, his thumb at the corner of her jaw. "Say it again," he murmured. "Cassius." She was the one who closed the distance. She had decided, somewhere in the long week of mornings, that if she was going to stop running, she would do it on her own feet. And so she rose up and she kissed him in front of the whole bright hall. And it was nothing like she had imagined, and everything she had not let herself imagine. His mouth warm and certain, his hand spread careful against her back, the gold wolf cool where her own hand fisted in it again. The hall made a sound, surprise and approval together, and she did not care. Let them look. She had spent her life keeping the door at her back. For once, she stood in the middle of the room and let herself be seen. When they broke apart, his forehead came down to rest against hers, and they breathed the same air a moment, and the candlelight moved gold across both their faces. "Stay this morning," he said. The old words. Their words now. "This one," she agreed. "And we'll see about tomorrow." They saw about tomorrow. 3 months on, the river had turned from gray to the hard, bright blue of full winter, and the cliffs above Duskwater Hold wore their first snow like a mantle, and Seraphine stood at the window of a room that was hers now, in a corner of the citadel, where the light came in clean off the water all morning. It was not a cell. She had not stopped noticing that it was not a cell. Some habits of gratitude do not leave a person, and she had decided to let that one stay. She had made the room over into something. There was a long table under the window where she kept the maps, because the king had asked her, gravely, as if it were a great favor and not a thing she was wildly good at, whether she would take charge of the hold's couriers and the safety of its roads. Who better, he had said, than the best runner the border ever had? She had argued that she was a captured spy and a poor choice for a position of trust. And he had said, with that flicker of dry warmth she had learned to watch for, that he could think of no one he trusted more, having watched her refuse to betray people who paid her even under threat. She ran the roads now. Her roads. The trains crossed the mended bridge at Caldermouth on her word, and the warnings traveled fast and quiet the way she once had, and no runner under her care was ever a chip on anyone's board. Petra found her at the window that morning, snow light on the maps, and set down a cup of something hot at her elbow without being asked. "You've got the look," the healer said. "What look?" "The one that stopped checking the door." Petra's weathered face creased. "Took you a season. But it's gone. I watched it go." Seraphine wrapped both hands around the cup. It was true. She had not thought about the postern gate in weeks. She had not lain awake counting the watch. She had married the river country's king in a quiet ceremony with the snow coming down past the windows, and she had said the words and meant them, and she had not once, in saying them, felt the old pull toward the open road. The door opened, and she did not flinch toward it. That, more than the ring on her hand or the maps on her table, was the thing that told her she had changed. The door opened, and it was him, and the only thing she felt was glad. Cassius crossed the room, snow still melting in his chestnut hair, and came up behind her at the window and folded his arms around her, his chin coming down to rest at her temple, and they looked out together at the white cliffs and the bright cold river running on below. "The Eastern Hold sent a letter," he said into her hair. "They want a treaty. They've asked for it to be negotiated by your courier service, since you're the only one both sides trust." She felt his mouth curve against her temple. "The captured spy. Brokering the peace. There's a turn. I told you I carried warnings, not plots." "You did. I believed you in a cell with the key in my hand, and I've never once been sorry." His arms tightened. "Do you ever think about it? The gate. The morning you stood in it." She watched the river fold white over the rocks, the same as it had run the day they dragged her here with a hood over her face, the same as it would run long after them both. She had hated that river once, its indifference, the way it spoke, and did not care. She had made her peace with it. Some things ran on whether you stayed or went. The trick, she had learned, was choosing where you wanted to be standing while they did. "Every day," she said, "I made it 3 steps." "You did. And you followed." "I told you I wouldn't follow again. After the yard." His voice was warm against her hair. "I've kept that. I haven't had to. You've stayed every morning since on your own feet." A pause, and the smile in it. "Though I'll confess, those 3 steps were the longest of my life." She turned in his arms to face him, the snow light cool and the room warm, and the door at her back standing open the way he always left it, because he had promised her once that he would never close it, and he never had. She did not need it open anymore. She knew that now, but she loved that he left it. "Stay this morning," she told him. The old words turned around, hers to give now. "This one," he said, and kissed her, slow and certain, while the river ran on bright and cold below the white cliffs, and neither of them, for once, went anywhere at all.